really operate. So only milliamperes of primary current at numbers like 4 to 100, but I think you said you're operating at around 30 volts. So 30 volts at 1 milliampere implies that the peak power on the primary is something like 30 milliwatts. And a very, very safe sounding kind of voltage to start investigating your particular Tesla coil. And a properly probed oscilloscope, a fast-acting oscilloscope, I think is going to tell you an awful lot of what's going on in that secondary winding. And you can't connect the oscilloscope directly to the top ball, so to speak, on that secondary winding of the Tesla coil. It'll create too much loading. By way of a nearby capacitive sensing probe into that oscilloscope, because your voltages are so low, you don't have to worry about sensitivity. You've got all kinds of sensitivity that you can waste in order to make sure that you're decoupled, in order to make sure you're really seeing the natural resonance and phenomena of your particular Tesla coil. So I wouldn't even use a resistor divider network. I would use what looks like a capacitor divider network, but the first capacitor is going to be, let me pick a number, of 4 inches of air, so to speak, is the first capacitor of a capacitor divider network. The second capacitor is the capacitor built into the voltage probe that goes to the oscilloscope. That's the way I would do it. Let me drop. Now, when it comes to buying a $4,000 to $30,000spectrum impedance vector network analyzer, vector signal analyzer, I'm not convinced that that's going to tell you much about what you're looking for. What's really going on with pulses of energy, whether they be by way of a spark coil, by way of a pulse signal generator, by way of high voltage AC into a spark gap, no matter how you excite the primary winding of a Tesla coil, the secondary is a kind of a ringing circuit that rings down after each individual pulse for some number of microseconds. It's a rather nonlinear waveform. Normal vector-like instrumentation is made to look for steady state, unmodulated signals in general. Yeah, there is something, a very expensive instrument manufactured by Hewlett-Packard, which is a kind of a modulation analyzer. But I don't think you want to go there. I'm not convinced that these expensive instruments that you're thinking about buying are going to tell you a whole lot. The quickest way I would prove that, if I was in your shoes, if you really, really wanted to know, is to find somebody who's got one and borrow it from him for a weekend, or rent it for a weekend, so to speak, to buy the instrument, to use it just for this particular measurement, may not be justified. But that's just my first gut feel. I'm not really sure on this one. And yes, could you look at, let me drop. The next question is, could you look at other signals in the environment? In other words, two-way radios and handy-talkies and broadcast transmitters and so on. The kind of instrumentation that works best there is a so-called service monitor, an IFR, for instance. India Foxtrot Romeo is a very popular brand name. And that's the most popular brand name I know of right now. Hewlett-Packard also is in there. So is Anritsu and so on. But service monitors are made to specifically measure AM, FM modulations, subtones for PL type quality and so on. Service monitor is much more directed if you think you want to look at two-way radios and broadcast transmitters. A spectrum analyzer is a fun thing to have. A fast oscilloscope is a very basic instrument that I'm very sure you want. These other very fancy vector network analyzer-like instruments, I'm not sure that it's going to serve your purpose right now, but as you can tell, I'm not positive. Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, drag your feet in case anyone else listening wants to give us their wisdom on what we're just talking about. N2XJN to take it with a little bit of delay. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay. No response. Well, the last question is, Rodan Schwartz FSEA 3 spectrum analyzer. It's from 20 hertz to 3.5 gigahertz. And actually, this one has as an option the vector signal analysis that could be purchased additionally. And it has the AM, FM, the modulator with the speaker and ability to listen built in. So my question is not really that I want to spy on a various number of signals or get into the cable TV and trying to play with the programs. It's just that option is there, and it says that it helps. It gives the demodulation of common mobile radio signals and digitalized signals, and it worked with GSM, PCS, NA, DC, CDM, A, this kind of formats. So it's something that I don't really need. I really direct my laboratory to the one simple purpose, but it's there. Back to you, Andrej.
Yeah, that Rohde & Schwarz instrument you own, I think it's the first cousin of the one that I use very frequently. I'm using a Rohde & Schwarz vector network analyzer, the one that goes from some number of kilohertz up to 8 gigahertz. And it's a beautiful instrument. It can give you as many as 4 colors, 4 graphs on the screen simultaneously. You can measure all 4 S parameters, S11, S21, 12, and 22. You can measure those 4 scattering parameters simultaneously if you so desire, and a nice instrument. Now, should you buy the plug-in module that does all of that signal demodulation, I don't know what to tell you. I'm not quite sure. If you've got, if money is no object and you like having expensive toys, yes, that would be a fun thing to have. Is it economically justifiable? Is it a cost-effective purchase for what you intend to use with it? There, I don't know. I haven't owned that plug-in module, haven't used one of those, Wesley. Quite possibly when Eric comes on, he might know more about that plug-in module in his particular business with broadcast engineering. Quite possibly he has run into it and can tell you its strong points, its weak points, and is it a cost-effective purchase. Rohde & Schwarz, let me drop. Rohde & Schwarz makes some nice quality instruments. That's the good news. I like their features. I like their user friendliness. I like their software most of the time. I like their displays most of the time. But they're a little on the pricey side. They don't make cheap equipment. Not very many of the exotic pieces of Rohde & Schwarz equipment appear on the surplus market, is my experience, but I haven't been looking for them. I'd like to have a dynamic signal analyzer, the one made by Hewlett-Packard, the 3581, I think it is, 3581A, a real fun instrument, but it only goes up to 100 kilohertz, but it does it by digital signal analysis, beautiful machine. So, as you can tell, I don't think I've got the answer you're looking for. Sorry to say. A smart man knows a little bit about what he doesn't know, Wesley. And right now it looks like there's no one else on frequency that can help us. But I think we're going to get some help out of Eric when he does come on. He quite possibly has some experience there. And I'll turn it back to you for one more time. Although we don't have very many other questioners. Let me think. Maybe I can force a question out of Barry, but back to you for a final, and then we're going to go over to the mailbag, or Barry, I'm not quite sure which. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You know, the dynamic range analysis could be done with very inexpensively very especially with the network analysis from the Stanford Research Systems. I saw a few of them. Well, from DC to 100 kilohertz bandwidth, you can get them from $500. Really good stuff. Although, I would appreciate more input in this area. As far as Rodin Schwartz, the typical price for the beautiful one from 20 hertz to 3.5 gigahertz a spectrum analyzer is somewhere in within $3,500 up to $20,000 for exactly the same model. It's just that you have to hunt for it. I was taking a risk, but most of the time, actually all of the time, I've got lucky. I said, well, sometimes they sell something, say it's not working for parts only, and you change the fuse, and you have perfectly working $10,000 device. Back to you, until next year. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for a person with your background, Wesley, somewhat like Mel and myself, in that buying used test equipment, buying used ham radio equipment, very, very rarely do we get stung. If you have the ability to repair things, and even if you don't have the ability to repair things, if you have the right kind of an attitude where you say, gee, Andy, the BA2CDL is a good friend of mine. He's a prominent person in the repair department, so to speak, of the Limog group. He can fix anything. And he's got the test equipment, he's got the raw parts, he's got the knowledge, he's got the books, he's got the schematic diagrams. You'd be very hard-pressed to buy a piece of used ham radio or test equipment that a person like Andy can't fix. But 90% of the time, like you're saying, it's a blown fuse. You'd be amazed how many times when you buy something in non-working order, they're selling it to you as is, and they're selling it at one-third the normal price on the surplus market for that particular instrument, and you find out something very simple like a blown fuse or a blown mixer in the front end, which is, in many cases, very easy to repair. You got to be a little bit careful, although it's rare. Let me drop. Once in a blue moon, you'll buy something on the surplus market where they're selling it as is. They tell you it's non-working. They tell you they haven't tested it. You buy the instrument, and when you get it home or when it gets delivered to you, you find out it's got a beautiful-looking front panel and back panel, and inside it's empty. I've heard of a couple of cases like that where somebody has been using a particular instrument in a laboratory where they had a whole lot of the same model number, and this is the one they were cannibalizing. They were canning it, as they say. In other words, they were using it as a source of spare parts to maintain all of the other instruments of a similar type. And the one you're buying has a whole lot of missing parts, or it's almost a completely empty cabinet. It's rare, but I've heard of cases like that, and I know of one person who ran into that situation. But except for a couple of cases like that, everything I bought on the used ham radio market, like the radio you're listening to right now, I'm extremely happy with it. I paid a small fraction of the brand new price. I got something that has a whole lot of good track record in history, and except for after I was using it for about 10 years, one of the solder joints inside opened up on the power supply for a rectifying diode, and it didn't take me very long to find why the radio would periodically go dead as that printed circuit board connection would open up. Let me drop. And except for that little bit of troubleshooting I had to do one day, I've gotten an awful lot of service out of this thing. For me to buy this particular radio, a Kenwood TS-711A, which was 1987 vintage or so, I'd have to pay $2,000 and above to get essentially the same quality today. And I think I bought this thing for a couple of $100s. So that's like 10% or 15% of the price. And I like it. It doesn't have some of the latest horns and whistles, but for me it's good enough. So I'm a big enthusiast. There's another kind of philosophy that many ham radio operators start off with where everything has to be brand new, completely shiny front panel, absolutely not one single scratch in it. They want to have the original plastic wrap, the original box unopened with the original seal on the box, the original owner's manual, and whatever. They want that degree of brand newness. They want to be sure that they are the very first person that ever used it. Well, I can understand how some people get pleasure out of that, but you're going to pay a lot of dollars for it, and the rate at which you get failures is only going to be a little bit better. Sometimes brand new out of the box on a piece of test equipment where you're buying serial number 5 on a brand new product being put on the market, sometimes they've got some bugs in them, so to speak, that haven't been ironed out yet. So you pays your money, you takes your choice. Let's see if Joe is there. Joe, we haven't gotten to you in past weeks, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. We're going to give a nice long delay and see if you would like to sign in. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W on the deck net. I don't think Joe is there. One quick call to Barry, N2 Moon Bounce. What's the latest, Barry, on your seeking of antennas that have high directivity at HF frequencies? N2 Moon Bounce, if you're there. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Barry just walked in, Dick. He's in my house, N2EO. He's a good friend. He picked up cat food for me because I can't get out and we don't want jingles to starve.
Would you like a space report, WS2N, if Barry can't make it?
Yeah, we're going to do that also. And we're getting very close to the time. We should go over to the mailbag. First, Barry, apparently you're visiting some crazy guy in Whitestone. I don't know what in the world you're going there for, but he's got some good radio equipment. So give us a couple of sentences, Barry. What's going on radio-wise with you these days? N2 Moon Bounce at the microphone of N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, guys. Well, I don't have much to report, actually. I've been too busy playing with my grandchildren and going mountain climbing. As a matter of fact, I am going to be on a mountaintop, probably by Friday night. I'll be on Wittenberg, which I was on last week, and that's 4,200 feet up, and I am going to bring him with me, so that's something to report.
Yeah, that's a nice high location, 4,200 feet, Wittenberg. I presume this is in southern New York State. Is that true, Barry? And Barry, you've got to modulate that mic a little heavier.
Yeah, this is, I'm like central. It's in the Catskills, so it's, it wouldn't be southern. That would be central New York State. The Adirondacks are northern New York State. So it would be central New York State.
Okay. I'd like to hear from you when you come back as to how things are going. Let me press it over to Mel first. Mel, because tomorrow is a holiday, maybe the guys can stay up a little bit later tonight. So do you think we should take the space report next, or should we take the mailbag next? Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, as far as the young people are concerned, I sort of, we've got them now thinking. They're busy gathering thoughts. So I thought we just would leave it at that until some more questions start to come in. Most of them now have said that they are very engrossed in looking to build little projects, simple little projects. And I'm waiting to hear how they made out, you know, with some of these simple little co-practice operators or LED blinking circuits, you know, sequential blinking circuits, or possibly even a little further on a one or two transistor audio amplifier. So this is basically what I have been getting feedback from young people. So go on right now. Let's do it very well right now. Let's pick up the space report, and then we'll ask if we get anybody who may want to come in late with a question to pick over.
Very fine, Mel. We've either got a little trouble with the brand new antenna that was installed last weekend, or the propagation is not quite as good tonight. I'm not quite sure which. Your signal is about 20% noise on the carrier. So if you could aim a little more signal at the repeater, that would improve the signal-to-noise ratio. Now, Paul, what has NASA been doing? I did hear tell that the latest Progress ship, bringing up thousands of pounds of hardware, lost its inertial lock as it was coming up to the International Space Station, flew by the International Space Station, the last I heard, and thank goodness it was some significant distance away where it could be observed visually, but when it lost lock, it didn't come nearby. As you know, oh, I guess it was about 8 or so, 10 years ago, when the Soyuz, when the Russian International Space, when the Russian space station was up, one of the Progress ships crashed into it, and that could have been really lethal. And in fact, it did create a an airlock leak in one of the modules when the cargo ship came up and crashed into the space station. So the good news is that these spacecraft are unmanned and a little bit cheaper to run and give a higher bang for the dollar, if you know what I mean, to bring up more payload per dollar of boost. But the bad news is that final bit of navigation is done by computer control. There isn't a human being on board the Progress, and if it decides to crash into the International Space Station, my guess is life can get awfully complicated awfully fast. WS2N, K2RAW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, yeah. You don't want a million pounds or the equivalent of almost two football fields scattered around space due to a crash of a Progress docking ship, that's for sure. Yeah, this is, they're into the 30s, I think 35, 36, whatever Progress ships that have gone up there. And these things go up every couple of 3 months to resupply the space station. Sometimes it'll get spread to 6 months, but usually around 3 months. And yeah, they lost telemetry about 6 miles out. You know, I mean, it was heading that way, but then they aborted it. It's all automatic. The Russians have been doing that for years. And that's what I wanted to bring up, the Progress failure to dock. It turned out to be some kind of a TV camera that was on that was interfering with the telemetry. I'm going to drop it. WS2N. So the days went on. They figured out what the problem was, shut the camera down, and was able to successfully dock it today. So, no problem, which is important. You know, I mean, each craft that goes up brings the equivalent of 6,000 pounds. This one has probably about 25 gallons of water, you know, worth of water on it. Got maybe a little over 100 pounds of oxygen, a couple of thousand pounds worth of supplies, experiments, spare equipment, stuff that they need. You know, imagine 6,000 pounds. You know, it's maybe the weight of like two cars, or a little bit more than that, small cars of supplies. You know, I mean that's the net weight that goes into the space station. So it's important that these Progress ships make it up there. They have new ones that is being sent up by the European Space Agency. Let me drop it. They're called ATVs, Automatic Transfer Vehicles, again, unmanned. And I think they've sent up two of them so far. And they're much more complicated, much bigger than the Progress supply ships. And they hold about three times the amount of net weight that they Progress can handle. So with that, and the Japanese are working on one as well, you'll have plenty of unmanned spacecraft going to the space station. So with the two shuttle flights left, by the way, John Glenn is really pushing to keep the space shuttle missions going into the future. He says, look at one of these Progress things, you know, crashing up there. Now you need new equipment, maybe new modules, or who knows, deorbit a module. The only way you can do that is with the space shuttle system. You know, you don't want to junk the whole space station because one module is damaged. That's what happened with Mir. Mir, by the way, is the one you were thinking about, the Russian space station that was before the International Space Station. Mir meaning peace in Russia. Well, it was almost in pieces after the Progress ship crashed into it. It crashed into one of the modules, hit the Covant. The Covant is, you know, was a module that you could go in and do experiments in. And they had a leak in that, big-time leak. Let me drop it. And unfortunately, it's not like the movies where, oh, there's the leak, you know, let's get some duct tape and put it up there and stop. They couldn't find this leak. That, you know, that it was a big-time leak. Couldn't find it, never did find it. So they closed the 3-meter door on it, diameter door, closed it, sealed it up. Nobody ever did go in there after that. We did have one American on board, and get his name, at the time of that accident. But there hasn't been one since. This is the closest thing to it since that time. So I wanted to bring up that topic, as well as they do have a name for the new Mars rover that will be going up to Mars, being launched probably November or December of 2011, you know, next year. And the name is Curiosity. Let me drop it. And Curiosity, they know what kind of wheels it's going to have. The same six independent steering type of wheels, except, you know, really upgraded. It's a much bigger unit than Mars Spirit or Opportunity. And it's called the Mars Science Laboratory. That was the name it was going under all these years, but now they do have a name, Curiosity. So we'll have something to look forward to in the future, Dick. Back to that. WS2N.
Yeah, you get an awful lot of bang for the dollar out of an unmanned space station, unmanned probe, when you send something to Mars. As you guys have heard me say quite often, it is my prediction that our grandchildren are not likely to see a astronaut from planet Earth standing on the planet of Mars. The cost and risk to get him there is huge. The benefit is not very great. And the consumables required are just out of sight. It's obvious by these Progress ships bringing up thousands and thousands of pounds of stuff very frequently to maintain the consumables that are on the International Space Station. To have a supply line like that on the way to Mars is just out of sight. And so for a whole bunch of reasons, I just don't think we're going to put a man on Mars. But to send something like a Mars Science Laboratory, or the Mars Rovers, the Spirit, Opportunity, and now Curiosity. Same kind of a philosophy for that naming. I like it. And this Mars Science Laboratory, I believe, is again another quantum leap in size. The original Mars Rover, way back in, oh, I guess it was 1995 or so, 1997, somewhere around there, Sojourner, I think it was called. He did a lot of work. Spirit and Opportunity went way beyond in what they were able to do. And now the Mars Science Laboratory, I think, is another great big jump in size. I believe it's is it half the size of a Volkswagen? I'm going to pass it over to you on that one as I see it. Also, I want to know the two remaining space shuttle flights. What's your best guess as to when they will launch? So, the two next space shuttle flights and what...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Those two next space shuttle flights, roughly when, and the Mars Science Laboratory, roughly how much bigger? And my guess is it's not going to be a bouncing ball landing. That's going to be a real parachute and retro rocket when things get that big, is my guess. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. The space shuttle final mission is September, and there's one in between that. So I guess it's probably, I guess, the end of the month, end of July. I'll have to check. But last one is scheduled for September, so maybe early August, and late September, or something. And that's it. That's it. It's a shame, but that's the way it goes, especially without the Orion project coming online to follow up on the space shuttle. Constellation has been canceled. I'm sure many people know that, but I'll repeat it. So, no spacecraft to go up to, not only to the moon, that was the goal of a Constellation, but the Orion spacecraft would have been able to go up to the International Space Station. So we're going to rely on the Russians, and we're going to rely, hopefully, the private industry gets their act together probably within about 5 to 10 years and starts launching people up, then they would be able to go up to the space station. But the way they're going, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Unless they start awarding billions of dollars to the private industry, maybe that might do it. Now, Curiosity, let me drop it. Yeah, they say it's about almost twice the size of the two previous rovers. And, of course, Pathfinder, yeah, that was the first one. That was the size of, a microwave oven. And that was brought up by something, the Pathfinder mission was the mission that brought that thing up. And then Sojourner was the rover itself that drove around on Mars. The Delta II rocket, which launched both Spirit and Opportunity, is the same one that's going to launch Curiosity. And the payload weight is about the same. So what they had to do is improvise. When Spirit and Opportunity landed, came through the atmosphere with the aeroshell. Eventually broke loose, which left the landing pod on it, and the rover sitting on top of the landing pod came down standby. They had these big airbags that popped out, and it rolled around, and eventually it opened up correctly. Now they can't do that with this thing because it's too big. So the weight would be exceeded to use these big airbag systems and all of that. So what they're going to do is come down. The heat shield will break loose, similar to Opportunity and Spirit. But then while we'll be hanging, what you'll see there is, you'll see the bottom of the spacecraft, and that spacecraft will be lowered on gigantic tethers. From now, this thing is coming down on parachute, no airbags. So here's these parachutes opened up, and imagine being above the planet, and this thing all of a sudden being lowered down on these cables until it senses that it touches the ground. Or right before it touches the ground, and I mean right before, and then these cables are going to be cut, and that's it. You're going to have wheels on the ground, no platform to drive off of, when I understand it. So, I read that a couple of years ago. I don't know if anything's changed, but that was the latest plan on how that thing was going to land. Dick, back to you.
Now, Mars has an atmosphere that's only a small fraction of 1% of our atmosphere. It's a very thin layer of air. Yes, you can build an extremely big parachute or multiple parachutes and hope they all deploy correctly. If I understand you correctly, you think that the parachute is going to lower Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory. The parachute will lower it directly to the Mars surface. No other kind of reeling up the cable or a retro rocket. I'm a little bit afraid it's going to be hitting the Mars surface at 30 meters per second, so to speak. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, I didn't mention the retro rockets. On this complicated, the parachute has got the top part of the aeroshell, and the cables come down, and now this thing is dangling from it, attached to this aeroshell. You know, in other words, now it's above, you know, maybe 30, 40 feet above the this dangling curiosity. You've got, I think it was four retros, if I'm not mistaken, shooting down but to the side. So in other words, the gas isn't going to be coming straight down, hitting the spacecraft, hitting Curiosity. You know, I think it looked like it was coming down maybe 45 degree angles, maybe a little steeper than that. So yeah, these rockets will be firing at the last, you know, a few seconds, maybe, I don't know how long, but for the final descent. So, very good. All right, I think I kept it short enough, but Mel, I hope so. Good evening, Mel. And back to you there, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, so the retro rockets that are attached to the aeroshell, they fire, bring it down to some very small velocity. They have to be fired at just the right time. You have to hope that it brings it to a near stop and not blast it back into space by overthrusting. And then, with critical timing, you cut the cable between aeroshell, parachute, and Curiosity, and then let it drop the last couple of feet. Is that approximately the landing scenario? Boy, that's got to be timed just right, and you hope there's no local wind blowing when you do that, which tips it over. Over to you, Paul. Did I have that correct?
I saw the animation, and it looks like as it's coming down, the spacecraft, it was called, it didn't have a name at the time, a couple of years ago, and as it touched the ground, the cables looked like they started to slacken. I mean, just at that second, it looked like it broke loose. So my guess is it's going to touch, and then they have these cables that are going to be cut. But, you know, where are they going to be cut? I mean, are they going to be, you know, there must be some kind of, it looked like it was hanging by the wheels, but it must have some kind of support system to be hanging. You know, the detail wasn't that good. They've got to have some sort of support. The cables can't be attached. I can't imagine being attached to the rover itself. There's something that's going to have to be left behind on the ground. Because, you know, they have these explosive bolts with this guillotine-type mechanism that cuts these cables. And I can see them doing it up near the aeroshell. But down below, you know, you don't want these cables still attached to the spacecraft. They're going to be attached to some kind of platform or something below it. And that's probably, I think, the way they're going to do it. They'll probably cut them at that point. And maybe not at the aeroshell location. We'll see. I'll have to look for an updated animation, I think, there.
What's your guess as to how far the Mars Science Laboratory can drop to the surface and be safe? And is there a mechanism by which it can put itself right side up if it happens to land on a windy day and tip over? Over to you, Paul.
No, it can't go over. I think it's like opportunity. You know, I think 20, 25 degrees pitch, that's it. Something like that. It's got to land. It's got to land wheels down. It can't land on the side. You know, it's not like the airbag system. You know, that thing could have landed upside down, and then it would have worked. You know, by the way the pedal system opened up, it would have righted itself properly. But no, not this. It's got to come down straight. I know that. I know.
Right now, is that on schedule to take off sometime in the latter part of 2011? Is that what you said, Paul?
Yeah, between November and December is the window. You know, every 27 months, the planet Mars and Earth come into conjunction. You know, think about it, you know, the Earth, it's roughly, let's call it roughly 2 to 1, you know. So if the Earth goes around once, that means Mars went around a half a turn around the Sun. And then if Earth goes around again, that means Mars came around another half a turn. Now they're close to one another again. That's the optimum location because it's less distance for the spacecraft to travel. So that's why it's roughly every, I call it 2 years, but it's really 27 months that they have these windows, and it's between November and December of 2011, roughly a 10-month travel time. So in 2011, we should be watching a new rover, and probably, hopefully the other two ones still functioning on the planet.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you Spirit and Opportunity, as I remember one of them is stuck in the sand and is now becoming a stationary laboratory. Did Spirit and Opportunity go straight to Mars without any gravity assist by any flyby of any other planet? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, that was a direct shot. Yep. Delta II rockets. And, in fact, I don't know if it, I think every Mars flight, they never did a flyby of Venus first, and then, you know, Venus, Earth, and out. That's usually with the other probes. They've done that, Galileo and all of that. They've done the Venus, Earth, you know, flybys, but not a direct shot. And then they don't orbit the planet. They just they go right into, you know, they don't set themselves up. It's a direct shot right, you know, from Earth to the landing spot. Mars is on one side of the planet. On Mars, you've got one on one side, or Spirit, and then you got Opportunity on the other. So it's not like we can't put spacecraft into orbit. I mean, we've got plenty of orbiting spacecraft now going around Mars with Mars Reconnaissance and Mars Odyssey and Mars Global Survey. I mean, we've got three of them. European Space Agency, they have one of them, Mars Express. You know, we've all put them in orbit with aero braking systems and things like that. But it's just less expensive to have the spacecraft go in and land, not like Viking. Viking did this. Let me drop it. Back in '76, the Viking landed. There two of them. They went into orbit and they separated from the mothership. In fact, those things are still going around in orbit, not functioning. But the original Viking orbiters are still going around. They never did come down and crash into the planet, and then they landed. So we don't do it like that anymore.
One last question, and that is Spirit and Opportunity. At least one of them is going through a Mars winter, and I think there was some speculation as to whether or not there's enough battery energy left to come back to life when springtime comes again. What's the approximate status of those two spacecraft, Paul? Go ahead.
Spirit has been stuck for many, many months, but still functioning as a, you know, sending data back every now and then. But now it's in, I think it's into the sleep mode now. They hope it will come back to life. And then the other one is still functioning, but that goes into the, I think, the winter time at the same time, right? I think they were both south of the equator. Not far from it, you know, pretty close to it. And you've got Phoenix. They're hoping that thing comes back to life, believe it or not. They listen for signals every now and then. That was a lander that landed on a northern pole, but got covered up with frost and carbon dioxide. But they think that might even come back to life with them. Some people think yes, some people think no. But you never know. I mean, there's no off switches on these things.
Yeah, but some of the electronics on that extreme cold could be damaged, particularly a battery. Okay, thank you, Paul. Mel, other than lots of letters telling us not to be so verbose, are there any other answers that we should try to give over the air? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very interesting that Paul goes through all the effort and provides us with updating on what is going on in space. I'm sure many people are interested in hearing about that and the controversy about landing men on the moon, on Mars, even on the moon again, is very controversial. Controversy continuing, whether or not it's worth spending that kind of money now and effort. All right, with that, let's see. First, anybody that we missed, please. I don't want to get emails that we did not pick you up. I am going to take a specific break now. Everybody, shh, quiet, let's listen. Anybody with maybe coming in through ILRP or whatever, if you have a question, now's the time. Please, let us hear it.
K2RIW, WH4YY.
Very fine, Joe. I announced at the beginning of the TechNet tonight that if you signed in, you go to number one on the runway because you signed in 1 or 2 weeks ago and we didn't get to you. You've got your opportunity. You got it, Joe.
Oh, I wasn't signing in for a question. You know, I can wait till another week for that. I wanted to speak you offline after the TechNet is done, if that's possible. I think you remember my home number. If you can't do that, it can be sometime during the week, but tonight will be convenient because I don't have to work tomorrow. That was my message.
Very fine, Joe. But you've also got the opportunity to ask a question. And so, why don't you go and do it? We've gone through all the questioners tonight.
Okay, it's actually kind of a simple question. It had to do with direct television. That was one of my questions. I was just wondering if any of these stations had to change their antennas to be able to, to accommodate wider bandwidth on some of these lower frequencies that they're using, because I have gotten traffic on out-of-state traffic on channels 4 and 5 from a couple of different stations already. It just makes me wonder if they had to change their antennas to accommodate the wider bandwidth of the DTV signal that you just use. That was my question.
Let's see if Eric is available. KE2EJ, are you on frequency? K2RIW on the TechNet?
He's in Canada.
We didn't give him permission to go there. When you're talking about greater bandwidth, Joe, I don't think so. In other words, the old analog television, each individual channel was essentially 6 megacycles wide. The new digital television is 6 megacycles wide, each individual channel. That's the good news. The bad news is that the channel identification number and the real frequency they're on, with the exception of channel 21, channel 11, and channel 13, and channel 7, everybody has moved. So 7, 11, 13, and 21, locally, are on their old frequency. Everybody else is on some other frequency. That, I think, is going to cause them to change antennas, not because of bandwidth. It's a new frequency. Frequency or frequencies. So I am guessing Eric would have given us information along those lines if he wasn't in Canada. And even if he's in Canada, I think there's a chance he might sign in by one of the digital modes, by one of the internet modes. Yes, I'll admit that the digital television fills up the 6 megacycle channel with a more uniform signal. On a spectrum analyzer, it looks like what they call Bart's head haircut. But still, the overall bandwidth and, as I see it, group delay, distortion, whatever, all of those performance requirements, I think, are fairly similar if there wasn't a change in frequency. And yes, I guess I should give you a phone call tonight. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
OK, Okay, well, that was basically my question. The furthest station I've had a copy to date is North Platte, Nebraska, on channel 2, North Platte, Nebraska. That's about as far as I've gotten so far, and still counting.
When you saw North Platte, Nebraska on channel 2, was channel 2 its identification number, or was that also its frequency? Was it really on 54 to 60? Because locally we do have the Daystar channel now on 54 to 60. Over to you, Joe.
No, it was actually on RF channel 2, absolutely. I can only under extremely rare conditions get those channels on channel 2 and 3, their local low-power digital channels from New York. Only on rare occasions do I ever even see those channels. I've gotten the channel 5, which is DT40 WLNB from Toledo, Ohio. I got a channel 2, which is North Platte, Nebraska, on RF channel 2, which is also DT2. And I just got one earlier tonight, another channel 5, KHRS. I have not identified where that transmitter is located yet, but I will. But there's plenty of channels out there, Dick, so when people say they can't get DTV at their house, I can.
Do you ever get a multipath condition, Joe, where you're over the air, digital television broadcast on a particular channel experiences co-channel interference, and therefore your converter says no, it won't demodulate it, even though your signal strength indicator on another piece of equipment, like for instance your R7000 receiver, says yeah, there's plenty of signal there. You're listening to the pilot tone, for instance. I can get lots of pilot tone amplitude, but because of co-channel interference, my digital converter says forget it, because its signal strength indicator is really a bit error rate after it tries to demodulation. How do you, Joe?
Sure, Dick. That happened last week. I had my antenna aimed at 270 degrees, which is basically New York, and I was at times not getting WCBS from New York on RF channel 33, because the interference from WFSB in Hartford was so strong off the side of the antenna, it took out channel 2 from New York. When I aimed the antenna at 015 degrees, I got a full-scale picture from WFSB in Hartford, so yes, that can very well happen.
Yeah, you're lucky that you've got a aimable antenna on the top of your QTH. When you were getting the Hartford channel, channel 33 RF-wise, which is identifier channel 2, were you able to carefully aim the antenna, not at 270, but at some other angle, where one of the notches in your antenna pattern could be aimed at Hartford, and therefore you were able to reestablish the channel 2 from New York City? And conversely, when you aim toward Hartford, can you notch out New York City so you get a good picture from Hartford? With your aiming, if you carefully do it, I'm trying to find out, would this be a fairly strong piece of evidence that if we're a serious digital television watcher, that we really should be using a rotator that's got some fine resolution to it. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Yes, that's exactly what happens. And sometimes even you can't even go by the compass, because if you think the station's at, say, a bearing of 015 degrees, you may get it at that location, that azimuth reading, but you'll also get enough front-to-side signal off the unwanted channel where you have to actually turn the antenna to maybe 025 degrees, 030 degrees to be able to completely null out something that you don't want to come in. And that's precisely what it did do with channel 3 WFSB in Hartford. I could actually turn the antenna to 030 and I got a better picture. I could tell by this, but actually what happens is the bit error rate actually increases as you go sometimes off the station because you're getting more rejection. Now, to answer your first part of the question, yes, I put the antenna at 290 to 295 and that was the best picture I could get from Channel 2 in New York City on RF-33. I got enough cancellation off the Hartford station to be able to get a viewable picture most of the time, but sometimes it would just simply pixelate because of just, lack of signal, too much, co-channel interference, so that does happen. There's quite a few of these digital channels. I've got multiple channels at the same time, sometimes two, sometimes three. Depends how bad, how much the band is open. If it's really open up and down the coast, look out. I've got stuff way down. I've got two stations from North Carolina already. I've got stuff from Boston, stuff from New Hampshire. So there's plenty of stuff out there if you've got a rotator. And having a good antenna with good directivity also is a big plus.
One of the things that I think is going to be troublesome when I put a rotator up is that the signal strength indicator on my digital television converter operates very slowly. It looks to me like it integrates for 5 seconds, if you know what I mean. I'd like it to have a much faster response so that I could swish across various azimuth angles and say, yeah, there's where I want to be. I wonder if yours has a similar problem. I'm going to guess that you have to use the antenna aiming process, move it a couple of degrees at a time, wait and see what happens, in order to find out, does the sound of the picture come back for the particular channel you want to watch that has co-channel interference? So are you able to use the signal strength indicator for fine-tuning when you finally get close? I would say yes, but other than that, without some kind of a system of actually listening to the pilot tones, and my guess is the pilot tones do beat against each other, if by some means you can listen to the pilot tone and aim the antenna and tune from minimum garble of the pilot tone, because you're not getting both of them beating against each other, that's another way of doing the tuning process. So how do you actually do the aiming in real time, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Basically, by just putting the rotator in a sort of a desired direction, and if I still get interference, I'll go off maybe plus or minus 25 degrees or so either way. But I have used the K2RAW method of trying to minimize the zero beating between the pilot tones by using my R7000 hooked into the television receiver line with a splitter on the one particular TV. So that works pretty good, too. And that really lets you sort of fine-tune the antenna to get, like, a minimum zero beat, and it usually coincides where I get a fairly stable picture most of the time that way. So that method works pretty good, too.
When you do have co-channel interference and you're listening to the pilot tone and you're listening to a small difference in frequency between the two, give me some guesses, Joe, as to how much maximum and minimum difference have you seen. Does it sound like a garble? Is it a very slow wobble? I mean, when you got two different pilot tones, in theory they could be 1 hertz apart, and therefore you would just hear a sort of a wow at a 1 hertz rate. Or I guess they could be 30 hertz apart, you'd hear a 30 hertz tone. Oh, what has it sounded like when you did that kind of listening? Over to you, Joe.
Well, it depends on the stations. Some stations are very, very close in sync, where they must be getting the same clock information from the same source, Mr. Satellite, and they could be maybe 1 hertz off. So you will get a very extremely slow change of rate. And even rotating the antenna, very hard to differentiate between one to the other. Other times I've heard maybe sometimes a 20, 30, 40, or 40 hertz pitch, sometimes even more than that. But not all as precise as you like to think they're supposed to be.
I see one other possibility here, Joe, and that is if the two stations that are giving you co-channel interference happen to be both locked to the exact same satellite, in theory, there could be 0 hertz of error, because everything is now coherent. There could be 0 hertz of error on that pilot tone. I presume you don't think you've run into that so far. Is that true?
Well, you're exactly correct. I don't think I've run into that, and it would be pretty hard to really prove out, because if they are theoretically getting clocked from the same exact source very precisely, I would have one hell of a time differentiating between one to the other. But I bet you've got an idea for that, haven't you?
Yeah, I see the possibility of you aiming your antenna in various directions. You're trying to tune for minimum beat note on the pilot tone for the digital over-the-air television.